and I asked him what the hell he was doing. Heil Kruger had contacted him. Just like that, out of the blue. They used burner cell phones and pagers. Didn't trust ambient systems. Richard said the devil told him to kill a guy named Peter Driscoll. That Driscoll was part of the chain. So I went with him. Tried to talk him out of the hit. But Richard wanted me in deeper with Heil Kruger, and he thought if I was the one who killed the guy, I would prove myself to them. I had no intention of killing Dr. Peter Driscoll. You didn't know that Driscoll was a witness for the FBI, I said. He was just a name to me, said Vivian. I didn't know anything about him, other than his name. I wasn't part of the world then. Didn't know who this guy was. Richard had been told where Driscoll lived. This huge house out in Virginia, out in the hills. He parked on this private road, and we came up through the woods, scaled the gate, and just rang the guy's doorbell. I was giving Richard a long leash. Wanted to keep my cover if I could. But things happened so quick. Dr. Driscoll opened the door and fired several shots, like he was waiting for us. Hit Richard in his chest and neck, killed him right away. Hit me, too, in the leg. He was going to kill me. He was standing not more than 3 feet from me, and you know how fast things can turn. I pulled my weapon. His was a .357 Magnum, nickel-plated, a showy thing. Seeing his weapon is the only thing I remember clearly from that moment. 3 feet away when he fired. He missed, I said. Three shots, all misses, said Vivian. The gun was too big for him, and if he was trained on it, he wasn't using what he'd learned. Once he saw my gun, he started backing away. No stance, holding the weapon with only one hand. I returned fire.
Hit him 8 times, said Nestor.
I was using a Glock 23. Got off all those rounds in the first 3 seconds of the engagement. I managed to call 911, but was bleeding heavily. I passed out. She fell silent, rubbed her face with both hands. I saw the cleft of her left hand was marked with a tattoo. The same black circle with 12 crooked spokes I'd noticed on her hand as we'd walked through the orchard in our other if.
What is that symbol?
I asked. On your hand. The question seemed to startle Vivian from her memory. She looked down at the black circle, held it up for me to see clearly.
Die schwarze Sonne, said Vivian.
The black sun. Heil Kruger mythologizes what they're doing. He related the terrorism to all these stories. Harrier learned them while he was in prison. He'd repeat them to me, like it was his religion. Heil Kruger believes that there were once 2 suns, in a past beyond memory. The sun we see, Sol, and the second sun, Santer, the font of pure blood, the source of power for the Aryan race. The 2 suns warred in heaven, and Santer was extinguished. It became the black sun, burned out, the void of the sun, the shadow of all existence, the reverse of everything in this world. Heil Kruger says we're on the brink of Santer's return. The end of the world. The white hole, I thought. Naval Space Command had named the phenomenon, but the crew of Libra wouldn't have known that name. They were the first to see it. They might have thought it was a second sun. Heil Kruger must think of it as the black sun.
Heil Kruger allows this mark once you reach a certain rank within their group, said Nestor. We've seen it before. Not always on the hand like this.
Receiving this tattoo was the deepest I ever penetrated, said Vivian. I was told this symbol was a map.
To where?
I asked. Where does the map lead you? Harrier said the last step of initiation was learning about the gate and the path. Harrier hoped they'd tell me, but they never did. The Vardagr, I said. That's right, said Vivian, her eyes uneasy at the word. The Vardagr is the gate and the path. How do you know about that?
You know what this is? Asked Nestor. You understand this?
I know what the Vardagr is, I said, trembling, thinking of Marion and Marion's echo describing the mirror girl she would sometimes see, thinking of the FBI groping at references to this place, occult symbols, tattoos. Nestor hadn't known of Marion's echo. He wouldn't know the girl was still alive. I know where the Vardagr is, but it's a dangerous place. People die there. People vanish. Sometimes they return. I was told there is a path through the Vardagr. I was told this symbol is the map, said Vivian. Harrier thought that if I was ever at the Vardagr, this symbol would show me the way through.
I took her hand, studied the symbol. Concentric circles with 12 crooked spokes. Were the spokes paths?
We can go there, I said. I can take you to this place.
Where is it?
Asked Nestor.
West Virginia, I said. In the Monongahela National Forest.
We can go right now, today, said Nestor. Give me a few minutes to cancel my other appointments.
Preparing to lose myself again in that place, the ashen white trees repeating, wondering if Nestor would think of his father and his father's dream of the eternal forest. Doorways in the trees leading to other forests, and other doorways and other trees. Left alone in the office with Vivian, hesitant to revisit these words and memories that had caused her such pain. She'd killed Driscoll, had to justify herself. She lived under the weight of murder.
You don't remember me, do you?
She asked. Her question startled me. Had we known each other before? But how would that be possible? How would she remember my memories of things that never were? Thinking of the first time I'd seen her, shucking corn in the orchard side yard. I'm sorry, I said, trying to place her. She said,
You asked me to help you out once. Maybe 20 years ago? That night changed my life. You said I should look into law enforcement.
You had blue hair, I said, speaking the words before the image of the young woman had fully formed. A teenager with a shock of electric blue hair. The fizz of recognition was tickling. The young woman who drove me in a golf cart through the early hour dark of the Blackwater Lodge cabin trails had aged 20 years.
I remember you, I said. My God, of course I remember you. I probably told you my name was Petal or Willow, she said.
Petal? That's right.
Hippie days.
Her life had turned on a comment I'd made.
You must be my lucky penny, I said. You turn up whenever I need you.
You look incredible,
said Vivian, relaxed now.
Everyone always tells me that law enforcement officers have a lower life expectancy than the general population, but you figured something out.
Scandinavian bones, I said. Biologically, we were a similar age, but I should be decades ahead, in my early 50s, she would think, or close to 60. Believe me, I feel old.
When I saw you, I wasn't sure if I actually recognized you. I couldn't believe it. You look absolutely identical to how I remember you.
I'd dye my hair, I said, all the gray.
I talked to William Brock that night out at the lodge, said Vivian. Told him about finding that body with you. He told me that I'd been brave. A few days later, I watched the news out of Buchanan. And when Brock died...
I remember Brock, I said.
The news hit me hard. I just met this man everyone was calling a hero. I remembered what you said about law enforcement and went to an FBI info session. That night was a fork in the road, she said. You choose one path or another, and your whole life hinges on what you decide.
We took Nestor's truck, a gray Toyota with an extended cab, Vivian in the back. I-70 Northeast Virginia cutting into West Virginia, a drive of several hours, most of it spent in silence or catching up about our lives. I kept thinking of the way Nestor had referred to Nicole as Cole. A pesky nit, like I was jealous. But I chewed on the casual shortening of her name. I'd called her Cole only after I'd known her, only after all those nights in the Mayor's Inn. Cole. Reality television. Scratch-off lotto cards. Taking her home with me to watch her through over-medicated and drunken nights. We entered the Monongahela National Forest. Cole. They would have met when Nestor first interviewed her, days after Vivian and I had found Mersault's body in the Blackwater Lodge. deeper into the forest, the sensation like drowning in shade and hemlock. Nestor and Nicole. A relationship grown between them, maybe. Maybe in other futures, too. My heart caught. Nestor's link to Buchanan. Nestor buying Ashley Beetak's house at Buchanan. Because of Nicole. They had met when Nestor interviewed her about Marion, and a few months after that, she'd contacted him, asking him for help. They had met. They had grown close. Nestor and Nicole. Together. Cole. "Slow down a bit," I said. "There's an access route here. Or there used to be. It's easy to miss. There. There it is." Nestor pulled to the access route, pushed the gas, and drove up the steep path that would lead to the clearing. The same place he'd driven me in another future, to show me where Marion's bones had been found. Nestor had said something that night, our first night spent together, that the eternal forest was deeper than Christ. "We're near the Blackwater Lodge," said Vivian. "If you hike down the hill, you'd get there." "We have to get higher up to see the Vardagr," I said. "But park here. There's a clearing ahead. It's the farthest you'll be able to drive." The clearing was ruined with growth and weeds, but was flat enough for Nestor to park. I climbed from the cab, careful of my step. I wasn't wearing clothes for hiking, but my shoes would be fine. The sturdy, skid-resistant work shoes I usually wore for balance. Vivian climbed from the rear of the cab, stretching out her knees. She was wearing clogs, thick-soled, but nothing would keep them on her feet if she stepped in mud. "Are you sure you'll be able to walk?" I asked. "We have a little bit of a hike. Not too bad, but it's mostly uphill." "I should have worn something else," were Vivian's last words. Nestor drew a sidearm and shot her point-blank in the side of her head. She dropped to her knees, moaning. Nothing intelligible. Just the brute, wet sounds of a dying animal. All life was gone even though she was alive. Mewling. Spit and blood burst from her mouth, her hands waving in front of her like she was warding off insects. I reached for my weapon, but Nestor kicked the knee joint of my prosthesis, toppled me. He struck me in the side of my head with his gun. My jaw clacked. Nestor knelt over me, cuffing my hands behind me. He took my weapon, cleared the bullets, and tossed it in the back of his truck. Vivian was groaning. Cascading blood veiled her. "Kill her," I said. "Just kill her." Nestor put his weapon to Vivian's forehead and shot her a second time. The gunshot echoed like the crack of a falling branch. Vivian flopped backward, dead against his tire. "Think. Think." I was cuffed, and he'd taken my gun. This was all too easy. Vivian's body gurgled death sounds. "Vivian is a girl named Petal," I told myself. "Vivian is a girl at the Blackwater Lodge who calls herself Petal. She's still alive at a hotel desk in 1997. I could maybe get to my knees, but I'd be so slow through the woods. Even if I had a head start, he'd catch me quick. Nestor got back into his truck, left the driver's door open. I saw him with a walkie-talkie, finding a channel.
"I've got something for you down here,"
he said. I couldn't hear the responding voice through the static.
"Yeah, a woman named Shannon Moss," said Nestor. "I had to take care of someone she brought with her. I can't put her in my truck."
A moment later, he said.
"All right."
"Why are you doing this?" I asked. "Nestor, please."
"Keep your wits about you," said Nestor. "I bet they won't do anything to you."
He pulled me up, made sure I had my footing.
"They were interested in you. For years they were interested. We have a little ways to go," he said.
"Don't do this."
"Go,"
he said. He shoved me forward. I walked with him, and he guided me through a slender breach in the trees, along a snaking path and up a steeper climb. We'd come to the narrow runnel that led to a descending slope, the creek that had run dry, the mud speckled with smooth stones mostly overgrown now with weeds. "You and Nicole were together," I said.
"For a time,"
he said. The duplicity raked at me, realizing the people I'd thought were orbiting me had been orbiting each other all along.
"What did you and Nicole talk about?" I asked. "What did she tell you?"
"Cole, she showed me things."
"I can help you," I said.
"She might be up here," said Nestor. "I don't know if she'll come."
The sound of rushing water. The red run. Nestor guided me through a thicket of hemlocks, and we came to a fence, chain link topped with coils of barbed wire. Orange signs along the fence. Posted. No trespassing. Hunting, fishing, trapping, or motorized vehicles are strictly forbidden. Violators will be prosecuted. Department of the Navy, United States of America.
"They abandoned this place years ago,"
said Nestor, guiding me to a spot in the fencing that had been cut away, the egress hidden by trees. We ducked to get through, and once inside the perimeter I saw the ashen white tree. The thin space. This had once been a Navy installation. A concrete shed stood nearby. A garage, empty now. Nestor brought me to the tree.
"On your knees,"
he said.
"Over here."
I hesitated and he struck me with his gun again, this time against my back. Enough of a jolt that I stumbled forward and complied, dropping to my knees in front of the Vardagar tree. He unlocked one wrist from the handcuffs. This is what happened to Marion, I thought. Nestor pulling my arms around the thin trunk, my face and chest pressed against the cold, smooth bark like I was hugging it. He brought my wrists together and cuffed them around the tree. I pulled at the cuffs thinking, one Marion had been tied with twine, the other had been tied with wire.
What did Nicole show you? What could make you do this?
She took me through here. She led me through this tree, said Nestor. She led me down the path and I saw things. I don't know what I saw. I saw myself forever. I saw that everything was ice. I saw the end of everything, Shannon. Not the end of everything. You said I was religious when you knew me? Religion isn't the right word now. I called out to God in that ice, Shannon. And when he answered, I learned that the voice of God is worse than his silence. Nicole said, "Open your eyes." She made me keep looking, and I saw the image of Christ crucified, but an upside-down reflection of the cross, an eternal forest of crucifixions grown in the air. Not the end of everything, you're right about that. I believe in eternal life, but not like I used to. I have no soul, none of us do. I'm organs and tissues and fluid, but no soul. God is a parasite that lives in your blood, Shannon. I saw all those crucifixions. God's doing. Those people will never die. They'll suffer forever. Eternal life through God? Worse than death.
Nestor hung the handcuff keys on one of the branches.
I think I loved you once, he said. You might not believe me, but I loved you. When I first met you, those first few days working with you, maybe things would have been different if you hadn't disappeared. I don't know, but the hour's late.
Don't leave me out here, I said.
But Nestor had already left me. I heard his footsteps padding over the hemlock needles and soon lost his sounds to the wind.
Marion was tied here, but she escaped, I thought. She came through the river and saw herself here.
I wondered if I was here too, handcuffed to this tree. Another me, reflecting forever, an echo in echoing worlds. Hemlocks shredded the burnished orange of late afternoon. After a time, I heard men approaching. They appeared through the trees as wary as stags scenting hunters. Cobb, and another man I didn't recognize. A man with blonde hair and a shaggy beard. They wore tawny clothes, green camo and boots. Both men with AR-15s slung over their shoulders. Cobb bent down, looked me in the eye. Beefy, his eyes dull.
"It really is you,"
he said, smirking. I held his gaze until he looked away, spat. "Defenseless, my arms stretched around the trunk, hands cuffed," Cobb said.
"It's her!"
and reached back and swung his hammer hand, struck my face. I felt my nose break and the deep sting radiate through the back of my skull. I was bleeding. My blood spurted onto the white tree, ran down my nostrils into my mouth. The other man laughed, and Cobb swung again, smashing my mouth.
"This is the bitch that killed Jared,"
he said. He swung again, another pulverizing blow to my face. I couldn't move, couldn't shield myself from him.
"She's only got the one leg," said the other,
who was content to watch, grinning. I saw my teeth in the blood on the roots of the Vardagger. I was cowering, pain flooding through me, knowing I was exposed, knowing that Cobb could kill me if he'd wanted. But he said,
"Get the cuffs."
My hands were released, but they pulled my wrists together in front of me, replaced the cuffs.
"Help me with her," said Cobb.
The two men lifted me, dragged me, but Cobb said,
"Can you walk?"
And I knew to walk, fearing what they might do to me otherwise. I'd given myself up to them, surrendered. Three swings had broken me. My face rained blood down the front of my clothes, more blood than I would have thought possible. My vision was dark at the edges, as if shadows encroached wherever I looked. Cobb pulled me sharply away from the tree, downhill toward the sound of rushing water. Instead of one ashen-white tree surrounded by pines, I now saw a line of white trees stretching out towards some distant vanishing point. Identical white trees.
"What's happening?"
I asked.
"A trick of the eyes,"
said Cobb.
3. This must be an illusion, I thought. An infinite recursion of identical trees. They were spaced every 50 feet or so, and we followed the path they made. But it was difficult to follow the line of trees, a struggle to stay on the path. Soon the forest changed around us, the surrounding pines denser, brushing us with needles. I feared we would be lost among those repeating trees, but Cobb shouldered through a tangle of boughs, and we came into the clearing near the river. My body grew cold with revelation. This was the Red Run. This was the Vardagger. The pines, the clearing, the river. But unlike the last time I'd been here, when I recognized the features but not the place, I knew that this was where I had been crucified. Unsure of how to comprehend what had happened here so many years ago, so many years from now, an experience I still struggled to understand. A sea-swept discomfort remembering ice and the frozen husks of burnt trees, the blizzard snows. I remembered my skin like a chemical fire, and unfastening my spacesuit and stepping naked into winter winds. Deep numbness, ice, a river as black as ink. I had been crucified in the air. I had been hung from a cross I couldn't see. One of the Vardagger trees had been felled and lay across the rushing black water like a footbridge, its branches hewn away. Close to a dozen men had gathered near the felled tree, wearing winter coats or draped in heavy blankets. Only one of the men approached me, however, as Cobb and his companion forced me to my knees in the grass. A taller man, lean. He swept toward me with a bouncy step. His hair was reddish-gold, catching the sunlight like a fiery halo. Unlike the others, whose beards grew natty and unkempt, this man was clean-shaven, with sharp bones and sculpted cheeks and eyes that rested in pools of shadow. What was it Marion had said? The devil. Patrick Mersault had told Marion that the devil could devour people with his eyes. I felt sure Hild Kruger could be the devil in flesh. He moved with a serpentine grace. His mouth hung slightly open, the tip of his tongue touching his lips, like he could taste me in the air.
"Shannon Moss," he said. "I don't recognize you from your photograph. Who did this to you?"
"What do I look like?" Sick at the thought of my injured face, I felt smooth gaps in my gums with my tongue. sliding it into the bleeding spaces between my teeth. I could feel my nose hanging, pain, pulsing. "Cobb," I said.
"He ruined you," said
Heilkruger. My senses were heightened. Wherever we were was a different forest from the forest Nestor had brought me through. Different from the place where I'd been with N'Joku and O'Connor. There were no birds here. No sound here at all beyond the sounds we made. A peculiar silence. I could see the boughs of the surrounding trees moving, but couldn't hear their movement. Heilkruger unsheathed a hunter's knife, a serrated black blade. He came around behind me. "No, no, no," I thought. "He'll kill me." "You can't," I said. "You can't do this. I'm the Traveler." Cobb still held me, gripped me tighter, his hands like iron rings bracing me. Heilkruger grabbed my hair, wrapped it once around his wrist, and pulled my head back, exposing my neck. A premonition of the cut across my neck, of my neck opening like a second mouth. "Don't kill me," I said. "You can't. I'm the Traveler. If you kill me, your whole world dies. Your universe dies. I'm the Traveler. I'm..."
"You think we'll turn to nothing," said Heilkruger. "I'm not so sure about that. We're within the Vardagr here, this strange place. You think we'll turn to nothing if I kill you?"
"I'm NCIS. You know that," I said. "You know who I am. Shannon Moss, March 1997. That's the date. March 1997 is Terra Firma. You'll die if you kill me." Cobb said, "Fuck!" But I felt Heilkruger's grip on my hair tighten. I was pulled upward, my head yanked back. "My neck. He'll slash my neck." But I felt the blade tug at my hair, cutting it. When he let me go, I saw Heilkruger holding a handful of my hair like it was the pelt of a skinned rabbit. "I know you," I said. "I know who you are. Carl Heilkruger. You took out the Sieges building with sarin gas. The FBI building in Clarksburg. You killed 1,000 people. You killed Patrick Mersault, his family. You killed children."
"So you came to this time looking for me?"
he asked.
"That wasn't me. That was just some premonition of me."
"That was a different you," I said. "I was investigating all your killing, and learned about the murder of a lawyer named Carla Durr. Led me to Nestor." Heilkruger sheathed his knife.
"Driscoll," he said. "So you're following that thread?"
He strung my hair through one of his belt loops. I'd just pronounced a death sentence on all of them by telling them they were all part of my if. I knew that Heilkruger was figuring out what to do with me, deciding if he would kill me and throw away his own life with mine. But he had already rejected suicide once before, I knew. They had all mutinied to stay alive.
"We're shadows to her,"
Heilkruger said to the surviving Libra crew.
"Get out of here. Leave me alone with her."
The others dispersed, following the line of Vardagr trees to the riverbank. They climbed the roots of the fallen tree onto the trunk and made their way across the Red Run. There were ropes alongside the tree they held for balance, the tree made into a footbridge. Each one of them seemed to disappear before he'd made it fully across the river, like they'd all slipped behind an invisible curtain that hung halfway across.
"You're from 1997, said Heilkruger. "You must have access to your own ship. A cormorant, maybe. Think of all the possibilities you have seen. Think of all the futures. Do you report back to your government about what you have seen?"
"I do. We all do. We're trying to prevent..."
"Your government knows what will happen in the coming years," he said. "They're watching world events like they're watching reruns. But the same tragedies occur. Why is that?"
"Why did you kill those children?" I asked. "Mersault's children. And you sent someone to murder that scientist, Dr. Driscoll. Why?
Why the chemical weapons? Why all the killing?
Driscoll would have brought the universe crashing down around us, said Hal Kruger.
Mersault, too. Wake up, Shannon Moss.
My visions of the future are the same as yours. You've seen everything that I've seen. You've seen the Terminus. You aren't opposed to us, not really. You're not opposed to us. You're just blind. We're the only ones to staunch the coming tide.
You brought the Terminus here. You did, I said. It followed Libra, burned through every future.
Not us, said Hal Kruger. The Terminus doesn't spread. It doesn't cut through timelines like they say. NSC will bring it here. They're the ones. The Naval Space Command will someday send ships to that planet we chanced upon. They'll someday find out our secret and go there. Whether next year, or 100 years from now, or 1,000, it will happen. They're too greedy just to let it lie. The Terminus will follow the ships of the Navy fleet back to Earth. It will follow them. The possibility of this happening is so very high that every future ends in Terminus. We're trying to weaken their resolve to find that horror. We'll kill anyone who wants to find that death planet. But the Terminus is closer. So they must be getting close.
Bodies in the fields of Seagis. Bodies in the Ryder truck. Sailors of the Naval Space Command. Scientists at the Naval Research Lab. At Phasal Systems. Hild Kruger would kill anyone who might rediscover Esperance. Every future I've seen, you've killed so many people. So many innocent people, I said. Driscoll would have gone to study that planet. So you had to kill him. Is that right? You'd have to kill so many people.
Break the chain. Cut all lines to the Terminus. Kill to cover the mistake in all our thinking. Everyone's critical flaw is that we believe in our own existence until we're shown otherwise. Everything we see and feel tells us we're alive, that what surrounds us is real. But it's all a damn mistake, all an illusion we can't see through. I've killed so many people here, but what has it been worth? If you're a traveler, what has it been worth? Nothing. But you, you can still help us. You can return to the true. You can kill the machine that will bring the Terminus. Make it feel less like fate, more like possibility. That's all I ask you. To bring back our freedom of will. Our other futures. Our chance at futures. Kill until every future doesn't end in death.
No, I said. I protect the innocent. For a brutal moment, I feared that Hild Kruger would kill me after all. That his mind had changed as suddenly as a summer storm. But he extended his hand to me. Helped me stand.
Come,
he said, unlocking my handcuffs, throwing them aside.
We have a ways to walk, and our journey is difficult.
Where are you taking me?
I need to preserve you,
he said. I followed Hild Kruger across the clearing, along the line of trees, pushing against the desire to leave the path, to turn around. This is where the echoes come through, isn't it? I said.
The Vardagr is the doorway to a mansion with many rooms, said Hild Kruger. Some of the doppelgangers come through here. They're confused. They think they're walking through a mirror. What did you call them? The echoes? The echoes cross the river here. They remember they'd been lost in the woods, that they'd somehow gotten turned around, as if in a child's nightmare of being lost. They'll come through the forest here, come to a clearing. They'll return to the river they were sure they'd left behind.
What about the others? I asked. You said that only some of the echoes come through here, crossing the river.
The others flash into being up ahead, said Hild Kruger.
We kill them when we see them.
They want to take our place here. Sometimes they've succeeded.
Who?
Us, he said. We see us. We fight an endless mutiny against ourselves. You see it happen. You see your twin, and you know you'll have to kill him. Otherwise, he'll kill you. He'll become you.
The Vardagr trees stretched ahead of us. I glanced behind and saw the same impossible line of trees stretching away from us. Marion lost in the confusion of this place, crossing the river, seeing herself. Echoes of worlds, echoes of lives.
You killed Mersault's family, I said.
Yes, with an axe,
said Heilkruger.
Patrick Mersault was willing to destroy us, so I destroyed him. He wanted to betray us in exchange for a governmental pardon. His 30 pieces of silver. He would have brought the Terminus to our doorstep. He was a fool.
When we made it to the riverbank, Heilkruger pulled one of the coats hanging from the exposed roots and gave it to me. He wrapped himself with a military blanket.
The end times are cold, he said. You'll see things, but you must keep walking. Stay on the path. We're crossing into somewhere else. There are dangers where we're going. I don't know what will happen when the Terminus comes, if it comes. But I assume this boundary will break like the yolk of an egg and hell will pass through.
I climbed the roots, stepped up onto the tree trunk, holding onto the rope railing with both hands. A surface like this was difficult for me. The rounded, smooth trunk of the felled Vardagr tree feeling more like petrified wood than rough char. I couldn't sense the slickness here, where the river spray made the wood wet, whether or not my fake foot had found grip. Heilkruger climbed up after me, following closely. I stepped, baby steps, sideways, inching along, holding the rope line. The river roared by beneath us, the black water crashing rapids. You'll see things, Heilkruger had said. Halfway across, the temperature plummeted like we had stepped from spring into midwinter. The sky became leaden, and the air filled with swirling snowflakes and flecks of ice. The landscape changed ahead of me. No longer the green of spring, but a scene of winter. The Vardagr trees obscured by blasts of snow. I kept inching my way across the footbridge, the tree trunk even slicker with a skim of ice, and all around us, appearing in the air as if the stars had just revealed themselves, were the bodies of the hanged men. Bodies crucified upside down, floating above the river and far into the distance among the trees. They were moaning, their noises a choir of undying anguish. I dropped to my knee, gripping the rope, clutching it to keep from being blown into the river by the winds. Heilkruger huddled in his blanket, his wild red hair rimmed with hoarfrost. Behind us, the clearing we had just left was now a deep arctic blue. I saw a speck of orange in the immense steel green of the tree line. I screamed in horror. I was crucified here, I cried, searching the bodies in the air for my own body. I was one of them. Heilkruger took me in his arms, helped me to stand.
How did you survive?
He asked. Snow clung to his eyelashes, and his eyes watered in the frigid wind. His hands were on my arms, steadying me. I was saved, I said. Even now, wondering if I would see the lights of the descending Quadlander. I was pulled down. I was rescued. They saved the wrong person. Look there, in the distance. That's where she is. That other woman is me. That's who I am. Heilkruger looked behind us.
That woman is dead, he said. You're here now.
I didn't know what QTNs were. I had come from a time when there was no Terminus. I was only a possibility, one of many possibilities. A point of pain centered my eyes, felt like it grew wider, expanding into an abyss. Everything about me was an abyss. He half-carried me to cover the remaining distance of the footbridge, and when we stepped from the felled tree into drifts of snow, he huddled with me, draping his blanket over me. Heilkruger carried me forward, onward. Infinite reflections opened around us,
as if my eyes were kaleidoscopes and everywhere I looked were mirrors. I saw us walking toward us through the sky, away from us above the river, upward through the earth, toward us from across the bridge. In the distance of every reflection I saw a point of orange. Heild Kruger forced me forward. The path of the Vardager trees began to curve, and despite the shredding ice wind, the air filled with smoke like we were walking toward a great fire, lung-burning blackness that shaded the sky to charcoal. Sparks of fire curled upward, were whipped about in the sky.
"Hurry,"
said Heild Kruger, leading me along the curving path of trees, the air a midnight of smoke. Soon the Vardager trees themselves were ablaze, no longer ashen husks of trees, but trees in the full bloom of fire. One fiery tree after another, like a line of scintillant torches. Orange conflagrations battered by the wind and carried upward, as if every tree were a tornado of flame stretching to heaven.
"Where are you taking me?"
I said above the scream of wind.
"This is a ship made of nails,"
he said. And ahead of us, I saw the black hulk of Libra towering above the eternal forest, a wrecked ship mounded with blowing snow. The monolithic bow was rent apart while the stern, housing the engine room, the propulsion system and the BL drive, was afire with spurting spheres of vivid blue light that flashed and were gone, a blinding strobe. We hurried along the path of burning trees, the ship growing larger in our view, and I saw one of the NSC inflatable concrete domes, a bulwark against the driving snow, a soot-black dome with windows dimly lit. I wanted to go there, to huddle inside for warmth, but Heild Kruger pulled me back along our path.
"They'd kill you there," he said. "No matter what I say, they'd kill you. They're trained to kill without question. The men in that dome are sentinels here. They keep watch for our approaching forms and shoot them down before they can escape into the woods. I've killed myself here many times."
And I saw there were corpses in the snowy field surrounding the ship. Countless corpses, frozen in all postures of death. Echoes of the Libra crew. They had been stripped of their clothing and whatever gear they might have carried. I saw Heild Kruger's body, and another of his bodies, and another. The burning path of Vardager trees terminated at Libra. We walked alongside the hull until we came to gangway stairs leading to one of the airlocks. The cold had seeped through my coat, made it hard to move.
"You'll have to climb,"
Heild Kruger said once we were at the stairs. Anything to escape this cold. But my hands burned against the iron railings. As we climbed, another blue spherical flare burst from the ship, enveloping us. A static jolt passed through me, a deep shock that stunned me, and for an instant I saw myself crucified. I saw myself in the orange spacesuit. I saw myself crossing the Black River. I saw myself as a teenager with Courtney Gim, blowing cigarette smoke from her bedroom window. Have you ever seen a flower called the falling star as it blooms?
"Keep climbing," said Heild Kruger. "Now's our chance. Right now. Climb!"
I looked out over the forest from the height of the gangway stairs. The ship was encircled by a great fire, an inferno of trees, waves of firelight that flapped in the wind like the flags of hell. I imagined Libra falling from the sky, damaged during the mutiny, its hull enrobed in fire and plummeting to the earth like a burning mountain, crashing here. Other lines of Vardager trees radiated away from the ship, countless lines of trees like burning spokes surrounding a hub, seemingly infinite paths leading to other sections of the eternal forest. So many pathways. A mansion with many rooms. I could see past the forest fires to where the fires died, to where the Vardager lines became charred trees. A burnt forest of ashen white. The snow mixed with so much soot that the horizon was grayed, the sky dark. The landscape was like a burning god's eye, and I stood in the black pupil. Libra. The fires and the Vardager lines churned around us, as if I stood at the center of a world-enveloping hurricane.
I was screaming.
Heild Kruger dragged me up the remaining stairs, to the airlock in the hull. But the hull was caked with rust, or something colored like rust, and flecked with white and brown.
No, it wasn't rust.
The rust color had been painted on. It covered the airlock and the surrounding hull like a thick reddish skin. Heild Kruger spun the lock, and the portal door swung inward.
"Go in," he said,
bellowing over the howling wind. But I hesitated. The portal to the ship, a perfect void, repellent. A circle of oblivion surrounded by the rust color and flecks and darker, stringy swirls.
"Fingernails," I said, revulsion rising through me. "And blood," I said.
The blood of the corpses surrounding the ship had been painted here, mixed with their fingernails and swirls of their hair to coat the airlock and hull.
"You painted this ship in blood."
The earth shuddered, and Nokvar was released from its moorings, said Heild Kruger, carrying the bodies of dead warriors to wage war against the gods.
Fingernails of the dead. The ship made of nails. Mersult's wife, his children, their fingernails and toenails removed, brought here.
Marion Mersult, the dead echoes. How many others?
Thinking of the scale of this death overwhelmed me, like seeing a mountain but realizing it was a cresting wave. Heild Kruger forced me toward the airlock, that black circle. I climbed through the shadow into the ship, but the moment I stepped inside Libra, I lifted. My feet flew upward from the ship's floor, my body spinning upward. Weightless, I hit the ceiling, bounced. No gravity. I was in free fall, rolling. Heild Kruger closed the airlock, my body a ragdoll ricocheting from ceiling to wall to floor with nothing to break my fall until Heild Kruger caught me. We floated together. There is no gravity.
"What's happening?" I asked him.
"Quiet now," he said.
We were near the engine room, and soon I heard the two-tone clangor of the power plant casualty alarm wail through the ship.
"That's the nuclear reactor," I said. "Something's wrong."
"The bull nuke was trying to break the ship. But BTAC saved us," said Heild Kruger,
his voice drowned by a clattering burst of nearby gunfire.
"Now,"
he said, and pulled me through the portal that led into the engine room, the place veined with tubes and pipes, cords and wires, most of the chamber taken up by the silvery steel cauldron shape of the nuclear reactor. Ring-shaped particle colliders encircled the BL drive, housed in its own compartment. It looked almost like a human heart, dipped in silver. The body of a man floated near the reactor, a long, sticky blood bubble ballooning from the holes where bullets had rent his gut. I could tell by his uniform patches that this was the bull nuke, the officer in charge of the nuclear reactor and the BL drive. Heild Kruger's eyes were wild. He ripped a maglite from the Velcro wall of small tools just as the nuclear reactor groaned and whined and the lights of the ship cut off, plunging us into pure darkness. The power plant casualty alarm still screamed, warning of a reactor failure.
"Move," said Heild Kruger, switching on the maglite. "We don't have much time. BTAC will be back here to fix this, and then Mersult comes to guard the pass. We don't want to be here when Mersult comes. We don't want to fight him. Not here."
"Tell me what's happening. What is this?"
But Heild Kruger struck me.
"Move,"
he said, and pulled me through another portal. We moved like swimmers through the passageway, Heild Kruger sweeping the light ahead of us. We passed the engineer officer's room, a cubby with a writing desk and filing cabinets fitted around the walls and ceiling. The engineering department had its own mess room here, and a meeting compartment with bench seating curved around a compact table. We passed the offices for the A-gangers, the reactor laboratory division, the electrical division, and soon came through a passageway lined with windows. I looked out the first window, expecting to see icy wind and raging fire, the pathways of trees, but instead saw stars in the infinite night.
"Where are we? Where are we? What is happening to me?"
Heild Kruger dragged at me, but I clung to the window and saw along the length of the ship. Where there had been several inches of ice coating the hull, there was now a crystalline crust, bright white and shimmering, like a coat of minerals, or like diamond barnacles encrusting the hull. The crust was thickest at the stern, over the engine room behind us, growing in jagged torrents of opalescence and radiating away from the ship like brilliant white sunbursts. "Why is this happening?" He struck me in the spine with the butt end of his knife, said,
"Hurry! The lights will be on soon."
He shoved me from the window just as the power plant casualty alarm fell silent and the dim running light snapped back on. We were headed to the brig, I realized, and I followed him, submissive in my shock and confusion, my fear. We came to the NCIS office, the walls stained with the spherical spatter patterns of weightless blood. "What happened to the NCIS agents aboard this ship? Where are they?"
"They protected the CO," said Hal Krugger.
He opened the iron door of the brig. The brigs on NSC turns much larger than their counterparts on waterborne vessels. NASA psychiatrists having warned of the possibility of space madness, even from the earliest missions. There were 8 cells here, stacked like berthing bunks, each cell an iron box. Hild Krugger took me to cell 5. I kicked against him and he hit me, opening my nose again. A sticky stream of blood burbled from me. I couldn't fight him. He grabbed my prosthetic leg, pinned my chest with his boot and pulled, hurting me until I managed to reach down to release the vacuum seal.
"I consider you a suicide risk," he said. "And I can't have you hurt yourself with this thing."
He locked me in the cell and left the brig, pitching me into utter darkness. I floated, fetus-like without sight or any sound. The pain of my shattered nose and broken teeth flashed like lightning through me. Soon, in that vast silence, I heard my ears ringing, and my breath whistle through collapsed sinuses, and heard my blood plash softly against the cell. Hours passed. I was an echo. An echo, I realized, of Shannon Moss, brought through to terra firma when I was rescued from the cross. I understood that now. The woman in the orange spacesuit was Shannon Moss. She was real. I had seen her. In the snow. That woman is dead. You're here now. I had come from an if with no terminus, but was just a figment of that if. An if that had blinked even as I had lived. An entire existence that had been cut away. Was I real? I was a void, an oval of darkness where my face should have been, as if my body were hollow or stuffed with straw. But the pain was real, the pain in my battered face, and my despair, and my fear. Aboard the USS William McKinley, O'Connor and I had once been forced to confront a sailor whose nerves were frayed by deep waters, who'd struck an officer. We wrestled with him. Brought him to the brig and placed him in a cell. He'd had the brig to himself. But the thought of this iron confinement and the solitude terrified him more than any other corrective measure could have. He begged us, pleading like a whining child for us to let him free. I thought of that sailor now, how he'd scratched at the walls. I was on Libra somehow, without gravity. I had seen the bull nuke murdered. But how was that possible? I heard distant sounds. A soft clacking. Like someone tapping fingernails against a table. Or like rat's claws scrabbling across metal. Popping sounds. And then I placed it. The sound of small arms fire. Followed by the louder clatter of automatic weapons. They're fighting in the ship. And I wondered if the Navy had found this place, come to rescue me, or the FBI, the hostage rescue team, thinking maybe Vivian had somehow lived, or maybe someone had followed us here. Then a scream outside the brig door, several people screaming, a wave of sound that died abruptly.
The brig door opened, and my eyes were pierced by a sliver of light. I squinted against the glare and was able to see a woman slip inside the brig before she closed the iron door, plunging us again into darkness. Nicole. But she was just a child here. A teenager. I heard her movement. She was trying to stay quiet. But she breathed heavily. She was crying. And in the dead silence I heard every soft whimper. She floated between the cells, floating nearer. And when she reached my cell, I said, "Nicole, help me." Startled, she whispered, "Who is that?" "I'm an NCIS agent," I said. "I want to help. I need you to let me out, Nicole." "I don't know you," she said. "I've never seen you before. Why are you locked here? How did you get here? Let me out. I can't," she said. "No, I can't." Another burst. An exchange of fire, louder now. Then another burst, right outside the door. Bullets ricocheted off the metal passageways, a metallic staccato against the iron door.
"They're doing it," said Nicole. "I can't believe. They've killed her. No. No."
Nicole's words were seared with tears. I heard her rubbing her face with her hands, saying,
"No, please. Please don't do this."
"Who did they kill?" I asked.
"Remark. They killed her. They're killing everyone now," said Nicole. "Remark and our whips, Chloe Krauss. They were together in the wardroom, barricaded in. They're dead. Oh, they're dead now."
This was familiar. This had already happened. And I thought of Nicole's confession as we stood together near the orchard barn. "But you're innocent, Nicole. You haven't killed anyone."
"I love Remark. They know that. I don't want them to kill me because of her," she said. "I've been hiding in the life support room, but they were checking every room, and so I came here. They're killing everyone."
"Nicole, calm yourself. I need you to help me. I know you, Nicole. I know that your father convinced Remark to let you board this ship," I said. "There was a feast in Mombasa. They threw a feast in her honor. When was that?" "Years from now."
681 years," said Nicole. "When Remark landed and Libra, we held a Rojo ceremony, celebrating transience. I met my husband there. He saw me wearing garlands in the almond grove. And my father, he wanted me to live. He convinced Remark to take me. And she wanted me to live. She accepted me."
"I can help you, Nicole. I just need you to let me out of here." Another clatter of gunfire. She came close to the bars of my cell and said,
"How do you know my name? I thought I'd met everyone here. But I don't know you."
"We knew each other in another time," I said. "We were close once. You knew me as Courtney Gim. We used to talk with each other. Almost every night. In another time. In the future from now. You told me about Kenya. You told me about the trees. That they looked like emeralds."
"I don't know what to do," she said.
"Let me out. I can help you."
"I can't let you out. They'd kill you if they knew you were here. They'd kill me for letting you out. For talking with you."
"Please," I said.
But she didn't answer.
I saw the sliver of light as she opened the brig door. I saw her slip away, and the brig door closed. I was alone in that darkness, and time dissolved. Hours, it must have been. Every so often, a sticky sphere of my floating blood bumped against me, and I despaired. Eventually, a deep, plummeting boom sounded through the ship, shivering through the steel. Another explosion followed, much louder than the first, and as the seconds passed, I scented a faint odor of smoke. A pun-